Hi everyone, Justin Chisholm here with another episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My guest this time is Irish around-the-world yachtsman and ocean health advocate, Damien Foxall. When it comes to ocean racing achievements, Damien sets the bar pretty high, with six editions of the Ocean Race under his belt, as well as wins in the double-handed Barcelona race, and record-setting non-stop runs aboard monster-sized catamarans like PlayStation and Cheyenne. As you'll hear in the interview, Damien grew up on a farm in Ireland close to the water and spent most of his childhood and teenage years out at sea with his friends sailing a range of craft from windsurfers to dinghies. Over the last few years, as the sustainability program manager for the 11th Hour Racing Team, he has been instrumental in demonstrating how performance, sustainability and business can merge into a successful and replicable model for the marine industry and beyond. Damien Foxall, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast. You live a busy life. You split your time between Canada and wherever the 11th Hour Racing Team is based. But today you're speaking to us from Lorient in France, is that right?
Hi, Justin. We're actually in Concarneau, and we've been based here now for, I think we're into our third year. 11th Hour Racing Team, getting ready for this next edition of the Ocean Race. We decided to design, build, and basically kind of base our temporary base here in Brittany. Yes, we've been in the Concarneau region now for a couple of years.
It's a hotbed of offshore sailing, isn't it? That northern French region.
Yeah, well, it was kind of, I think, a very pragmatic approach from Mark Towell and Charlie Enright to base the team here. Obviously, our kind of our real base would be Newport, Rhode Island, and certainly we will get back there again this year. But in the context of the exercise of designing, building a new boat, having access to, I guess, the skill and expertise of the Imoca class here in Brittany, it was a very obvious choice to come and base ourselves here. Certainly, some international teams try to do it from outside of the country, but for us, it was really about taking the sort of shortest distance to trying to achieve success in this development class, and it was very obvious that we needed to be based here.
And you've partnered up with Mer Concept. Tell us a bit about that organization. That's one of the organizations on my list to kind of dig into a little bit. So I'm interested to get your take on how that whole thing operates.
Well, listen, a lot of the teams here in Brittany are obviously typically based around a skipper, in this case, François Gabart, and initially around putting the team's boats and supports, as they would say, on the water, whether it's a Figaro or an Imoca or an Ultime, trimaran. And so that's very much the case, obviously, for François. But then many of the teams use their infrastructures and a very impressive base here in Concarneau, right on the fishing port, which is a little bit like Lorient, becoming more and more developed around the performance aspect of the marine and not just around the fishing industry. Mer Concept then use their infrastructure to contract out to and bring more work into their business. So they've a really diverse range of activities, where actually this winter we were two Imoca teams here in Mer Concept. They were preparing their new old team, which they just relaunched, and many other side projects. So there's a lot of activity, and it's really good to see, I suppose, the marine activity outside of Lorient now, with Concarneau being very active. We have Kairos just across the water here as well, Roland Jourdain's project. And of course, just up the road in Port-la-Forêt, there's quite a few other teams as well. So listen, we're in the right place. And I kind of feel like we're in the right place at the right time because, of course, primary aspect of our campaign is performance and entering a team in the ocean race with capability of winning it. But the other really important deliverable is the aspect of sustainability and how we can transition both our team and the industry to a brighter future. And as we arrive here in Brittany, I think most of the entities, organizations, companies around us are asking the same question. How can we do this? What does that mean to us now and in the future? And I don't think any one organization has the answer. It's going to be very much about a collaborative approach.
There's so much we see now and we hear from teams, campaigns putting together. It seems to be this whole racing with a purpose idea is really come to the fore now. You've been part of the kind of driving force behind that, as far as I can see. Has ocean sustainability, ocean health always been important to you, or is this something that's kind of come to you more recently?
Well, listen, I think, Justin, I think inherently as sailors, we all sort of realize that we're in a privileged space in terms of access to the natural world, and it's, you know, we get to see the ocean and in the natural world in a way that very, very few others do, and I think, to be honest, most of us have kind of taken this for granted. You know, I grew up in the southwest coast of Ireland, and sort of we basically lived off the land and out of what we caught from the sea. And I think kind of as a kid, we would have gone to the supermarket once a month. And of course, you know, kind of things have changed and we kind of all typically now live very urban lives and live out of supermarkets and grow very little of our own food. But, you know, I think that the contact with the natural world is really an element of sailing and especially offshore sailing. And I think the sport has really realized over the last 15 years that above and beyond just this exceptional opportunity to share some of these stories with our fans and followers, to provide a green blue image to our stakeholders and our sponsors, that we are actually in a very unique position because we can take on this mantle, I guess, of stewards for the ocean, and to be able to do something a little bit more meaningful than just, telling a few anecdotes and tall stories from the sea. And I think most importantly, when we look at fundamentally who we are and what we're doing, we are really a sport that's reliant on technology and innovation. And that itself comes with a really large footprint, especially when you look at the upper end of the sport and the development classes, of which Amoca is one. And this is both a challenge, but also the opportunity.
Now, the ocean race, the Volvo Ocean Race, as it was before, is very important in your life. I think you've done, I lost count of how many it was, something like 8 or 9. So six.
I think Justin and I might have lost count as well, but I think we're around six on the water, and maybe this is my seventh or something like that as part of a team. But yes, no, in the last couple of camps, this is my second time with Mark and Charlie. We were, I ran the sustainability program for Vestas 11th Hour Racing. We had 12 months to put a boat on the water and to, from my perspective, implement a sustainability program. This time it's very different. We basically had 4/5 years to train with an initial boat, which was Alex Thompson's old Hugo bus, and then decide on a design and set up the build of the boat here in Brittany, as well as basically entering both boats on a number of events, including the Jacques Vabre last year. I guess I've been in this space for a while, and it's really exciting to transition from being on the water as an athlete to taking that perspective and then sort of looking beyond to really who we are and what we're doing and how maybe we can do better.
I want to get into that in a little bit. I want to take you back, though, to your first sailing experiences back in, you said you were you grew up over in Ireland on the west coast there. I had a look on Google Maps at where you come from. It's a brilliant bit of coastline there. It's lovely to sail past, but it's pretty wild and windy, I would imagine. And you didn't grow up in the traditional way. A lot of my guests, you know, they talk about the yacht club and the sailing club, and they went through these various classes. When I did my research on you, you kind of said it was much more adventurous than that.
I would say more roots, yeah. And it's funny, you know, one of your colleagues about a year ago rubbed me up the wrong way. He said, yeah, you I don't know how he said it, but I was like, you know, so I became a bit defensive, like saying, yeah, you know, listen, we all don't come from the yacht club environment, and that's probably a good thing. And actually, I would say that from my perspective, it provided an advantage. It meant that I guess I kind of had a different set of experiences, certainly growing up windsurfing, sailing, whatever, on the southwest coast of Ireland requires a different set of skills than pottering around the Solent in an Optimist. So I guess it provided me, and it still does, with a very different perspective. And I think, you know, that's probably part of the richness, honestly, of our sport, because, you know, it's amazing to be able to rub shoulders with honed athletes from the Olympic programs, whether they come through the Optimist or the 470, the 49ers, or other disciplines and other athletes who come into our sport. And, you know, we're, you know, at the end of the day, you know, once we're on the international circuit, we've got an amazing diverse group of individuals that we sail with and against. And it's been a huge part of my life, I would say. And you know, I'm sitting across the room here from an Italian friend who lives in the Azores, down below, a couple of floors down, getting the boat ready. We've got an international team with guys from New Zealand and South Africa and ladies from France, and it's just a wonderful sport to be involved with. But you know, I'm very proud to have brought my Southern Irish perspective to it. And it sometimes strikes me, maybe Justin, if you don't mind, I'll just kind of pull out an anecdote. I think we were with the Oman Sail Project. We were sailing in the south coast of England at Cowes Week with the Mod 70, and we had a very famous English female sailor with us, who was both sailing on the boat as an athlete, but also had been employed by Oman Sail to, you know, do a little outreach while the team was in the UK. So after the event around the island, we were chatting away, and I was, oh, you know, what are you doing after this? And she says, you know, I said, you know, if you, you know, it's August, you know, are you going to go and do a little cruising or hang out with the kids on the water? And she said, you know, this is a lady of certain, you know, she'd done quite a few Olympics. And she said, you know what? I have never done any sailing that was not racing. And honestly, that shocked me. I mean, it sort of, on one hand, you know, it's very impressive, and it kind of highlights the intensity of the Olympic training programs. But at the other hand, it also highlights the lack of diversity in terms of what the sport offers. Our sport's, you know, fundamentally based on long distance voyages and transporting materials and goods from one country to another. And you know, the aspect of just getting out in the water and cruising around and discovery has been so important to my own kind of introduction to the sport that I kind of feel a little bit sorry for those who haven't had that opportunity.
Yeah, me too. Now, tell us about that introduction to the sport. Did you come from a sailing family, or how did it come about?
Yes, I guess it kind of did. I realized that because growing up in the farm, I'd kind of be rummaging around in the attic and coming across cardboard boxes of pewter trophies, and there were no yacht clubs where we were. But apparently they were from my grandfather, who sailed at West Kirby Sailing Club in the world. With kind of old trophies and broken sailing knives. And I guess at a young age, that piqued my interest. We also had a small fishing boat at the bottom of the garden, and a small kind of mirror dinghy type thing. And so, yeah, that was really, you know, sort of living under a corrugated iron roof in Southwest Ireland. You kind of hear the storms outside, and even on the calm days, and, you know, just always want to get out into it. And Derrynane Harbour was literally at the bottom of the garden, which is a very protected harbour, but with always a decent amount of wind. And I guess I really didn't have much choice when I think about it. My mother, she'd have sailed with her father, and I think my parents met on the Norfolk Broad somewhere. So, school pretty quickly took a back seat, which sometimes I regret. I would like to have had when I look at my colleagues and many of them engineers and bring a lot of depth to campaigns, but my path was to take me to sea pretty early.
And you went on the water, not racing though. This was with your peers. What sort of age were you at this stage? Teenager or younger than that?
Pretty much minute parents would kind of, yeah. I mean, we're on the water pretty early, and summer, autumn, winter. Sailing school was actually across the bay, so I worked for them for a while, and basically grew up on and in the water, as I say.
When did it become a possibility that your life would be based around this sport?
Yeah, well, listen, that, I think, was something that was just good timing. I think many of my generation, if I can say it like that, will recognize this. Probably when I was in the teenage years, the Whitbread had been running for a while and was still an amazing adventure, but hadn't yet become a professional sport. And as I sort of hit my 20s, the sport was transitioning to becoming a professional sport. I think it was just really right place at the right time. By that stage, I'd worked in England as a windsurfing instructor, wave sailing, etc. Had done a lot of, offshore yacht masters and things like that. And by the time I sort of started delivering boats across the Atlantic, I came in contact pretty quickly with NCB Ireland, who was heading off on the Whitbread. I spent close to 10 years working in the Caribbean and seeing the boats like Groupier Premier, Florence Artaud's beautiful 60-foot trimaran, which I believe Luc Poupon is picking up again to do an event with. And so seeing those events like the Route du Rhum arrive into St. Barts and seeing the odd Whitbread boat go past, that was probably the trigger which kind of incentivized me to move out of the Caribbean after having been there for a period and get involved in the, I would say, at the Grand Prix circuit at the time. With, you know, there was the Kenwood Cup and, Cowes Week, the Admiral's Cup. And I sort of, after a couple of years as a sort of, a nipper, I managed to transition to being a sailor on those circuits and meeting Paul Stanbridge and Gordon Maguire, Steve Hales, and kind of off we went.
Well, yeah, you make it sound so kind of straightforward, but six Volvo Ocean races. You won the one in 2011-12 with Groupama, and that was a race. I think that did it finish in Galway or
it did.
That must have been a magical moment for you.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you probably kind of just alluded to it there, but, you know, like I think like any athlete or area of business, there's a lot of failures for probably less success. And even some of the most successful athletes, you know, it's very much about learning from your errors and, you know, you can't always win. So, in some ways, some of the better memories I have are our performances where, you know, we might have done extremely well, but not necessarily achieved first across the line. But certainly Groupama was one where, along with the Barcelona race, I guess, the Barcelona Around the World race, the inaugural event, I think that plus Groupama were the two that really, I guess, stood out. And obviously the key aspect of Groupama was that, you know, listen, an Around the World event like the Ocean Race is a long process. It's 9 months at best. And if you include the lead up and the preparation, it can be many years. So prior to that, I'd already participated more than once. And some of those were longer and more difficult than others. It's a long way round when you got a slow boat, even when you got a great team. So it was really nice to see, you know, it's really hard just to basically put all of these aspects, elements into place. Which sort of, in some ways, sets you up for success. But success is never guaranteed. And, you know, it was really amazing, I guess, to arrive back into France to help Frank Camas and Groupama set up that team and that project back into an environment which I knew really well, having been based here since 96 with the Figaro Circuit and afterwards with the Orma Trimarans. And then to kind of, bring the Volvo experience that I had at that stage and to help the team to build up that project, which ultimately was a success. And, you know, the first scent of success, I would say, we had was, you know, right off the start line in Alicante, where, you know, we kind of in a tight reach past Isleta Barca, and we kind of quickly realized we had a really fast boat. It took us a few legs to take the fast boat to the podium, but you know, then we eventually gained consistency despite having lost the rig after the horn, and it was an amazing project, and the, you know, to finish into Galway, into home with a win for Around the World was pretty cool.
Pretty cool indeed. It's funny you mentioned that first night, because many of the skippers that I've talked to, Kenny Reid, Ian Walker, they talk about that last night, because I was there for that. That was my first race that I was involved in. I was working for the organization, and you guys were the kind of last boat out of Alicante after the little inshore section. And, you know, people could make what they would of that, but the skippers all told me that at some point you went tearing past to leeward on a tight reach, and everybody kind of went, oh, my God, this is going to be a long way around the world now.
Yeah, well, you know, it was kind of nice to be on the other boat for a change, and speed makes you intelligent and sets up for good strategy and tactics, and Frank had done a great job, honestly, in putting the team together and keeping it together all the way around. You know, once we lost the rig coming around the horn and ended up in Punta del Este, you know, it could have gone both ways. You know, that could have been the end of the race, but we managed to get back in the race, and I think still managed a third or fourth. And from then on, it was kind of it was onwards and upwards.
Just
and I guess, you know, kind of subsequently from that, the boats kind of obviously moved from Volvo 70s to the 65s, and that was a very different. A very different exercise, and it was great to be sailing in one design fleet. I think over that period, it's done a lot. It did a lot to kind of reduce the costs, the impacts, the environmental impacts of the Ocean Race, and so it's kind of interesting now to be back into a open class environment with all of the advantages and disadvantages that brings, both in terms of budgets, fleet size, and environmental impact. So, yep.
Yeah, I want you to talk a little bit about that dismasting, because that was an epic leg in Ocean Race history. We had boats on ships, we had boats pulling into ports on the Pacific side. You looked like you'd come through the Southern Ocean unscathed, you and Puma, and then on the way up to Itajaí, you dropped the rig and had to pull into Punta del Este, but you jury-rigged and finished the leg. Just how did that all come about?
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, we had a bit of, in our bad luck, we had a bit of luck because basically we dropped the rig, you know, I don't know, 100 miles from Punta del Este, which is kind of, I don't know if it's the only, but it's pretty well positioned for a pit stop in that part, long part of the sort of Argentinian, Uruguayan coastline. So it was a relatively quick motor in, gave the shore team time to get down from Itajaí for the rig to arrive. It could have been very different if we had lost the rig, a week earlier or, hell, 2 days earlier. We would not necessarily have got back into the event, and the story would have been very different. There you go.
you make it sound so simple. Now, let's talk a bit about the Barcelona race, because that's a race, a double-handed race in Imoca 60s that you won with Jean-Pierre Dick. Was that your first real experience of around the world shorthanded sailing?
Yes, short answer. I think by that stage, many of the crewed events had started to kind of shift from being four watches, five crew, the blue, black and green watch, and the sort of, fully Whitbread style, fully crewed formats. But, fully crewed events were kind of reducing the number of members on board. But it was the first time I'd really taken, I guess, my single-handed and double-handed experience and had applied it to around the world event. I'd spent from 96, 97 through until about 2004 or something, I'd been involved with the Figaro circuit and the Orma Trimaran circuit. I'd done more than one or two events on a double-handed Trimaran, which was quite frankly, out of this world in terms of an experience, ultimate experience offshore, shorthanded. I kind of didn't come empty-handed, if you like. And I guess, Jean-Pierre already had a well-established campaign. He already had a lot of success, especially double-handed, having won the Jacques Vabre with Loïc Perrin. And so the round-the-world event double-handed with him, it was a good match. And we got involved very early on with the actual build of the boat down in and commissioning of the boat down in New Zealand in Tauranga, delivering it up, and then ultimately getting ready for the start of what was going to be the first double-handed round-the-world event, which brought together for the first time the single-handed crews and disciplines with the with some of the kind of crewed sailors, and we had a really interesting mix of Vendée Globe sailors, Figaro sailors, America's Cup and Olympians, it was a pretty exciting event to be involved with.
Did you have any concerns over how you would get on with each other going into that race?
No, I don't think so. I think, by that stage, if people are involved with that type of discipline, they already have the right filters and the right approach to these kind of events. At least from our perspective, I do know that kind of from the grapevine that some of the other teams may have had some teething issues, because if you haven't been involved with shorthanded, double-handed sailing, then it is a quite an interesting challenge. But I think Jean-Pierre and I, it wasn't the first event we'd done together. I'd actually navigated for the Tour de France for him on a MUM, was it a MUM, whatever it was, in somewhere in 2000, and so and plus we had a lot of time to prepare. So it went very well on board, and the result kind of showed through, and we even got to manage to invite him over to Ireland with Luc Talbordet to meet the president and get some honors from the local yacht club, and that was all all pretty fun after the fact. I think what was kind of frustrating for me at the time was that we really had worked hard to find an Irish partner to complement the project. It was an exceptional opportunity at the time with a proven boat, proven team, and, you know, at a reasonably good profile, I guess, in Ireland at the time. But we didn't manage to find an Irish partner for the project. So we went out and won it anyway and kind of came back and told a few stories at home. But it was certainly a big missed opportunity from a commercial aspect in Ireland. And there you go. It just goes to show that sometimes you can manage without.
Yeah, exactly. And you are, virtually a household name in Ireland through your sailing exploits. Is that something you're comfortable with or uncomfortable?
Oh, well, I think, you know, to be honest, people like Annalise and Finn and, you know, the kind of more recent sailors, Tom Dolan, have done really well recently, and rightly so. They're probably more common household names, as you say, at home at the moment, and that's all in good and just. In terms of, you know, how that affected, you know, at the time I was kind of working in and around the Ireland, you know, I think what I appreciated most was be able to kind of come home and work with local schools, work with local yacht clubs, and, you know, kind of tell stories of beyond the horizon, what's out there, and kind of try to inspire a few other people to get involved. And, you know, the result again is, you know, we see people like Tom Dolan now doing really well on the Figaro circuit. In fact, when the first Figaro 3 came through, I managed to do the first event with him. And so, you know, those kind of opportunities for me to kind of feedback, I think were really, really nice. You know, how, you know, kind of media profile or public profile, you know, Ireland's a pretty easygoing place. So to be honest, when I go home, it's, you know, people discreetly ask, you know, ask me to tell a few funny stories, and then it's back to life as usual. So there's no chance of getting a big head or anything like that. And that's all in good.
That's very true. That's my experience of Ireland for sure. I wanted just to ask about coming from Ireland, and we had Justin Slattery on the podcast, another Irishman, and he talked about kind of packing his bags and leaving Ireland and going off on this huge adventure. Is there something about coming from the island of Ireland, which is relatively small in the great scheme of countries, that makes people want to do that, just kind of get out and see the world and use sailing as a vehicle to do that?
Yeah, I don't know, Justin. I guess, you know, kind of if we look at some of our Antipodean colleagues, we might say the same, right? Between the Australians and the Kiwis and the South Africans, we've got more than our fair share in the sailing world. Yeah. Maybe we need a few more Irish people. But listen, I mean, yeah, clearly, you know, I guess Ireland's got a strong culture of immigration and emigration, and you know, the opportunity for the few of us to use sailing as the vehicle to kind of step out beyond the horizon is amazing, and you know, Justin's done really well. You know, I guess we're kind of in some ways following the paths of people like, you know, Gordon Maguire and those before him, Harold Cudmore, there's many more coming along behind us. So, you know, sailing's as a sport provides so many disciplines and opportunities, you know, and I'm not just talking about obviously the technical aspect of being a trimmer or driver or an athlete, but just broader, you know, from a more broader perspective, all of the industry, professions that are required within the sport, it provides a huge range of opportunities, which I really think that the marine industry in Ireland and kind of the government as a whole is probably not done as well as the UK, France, and New Zealand, for instance, in terms of developing those avenues for young professionals. And it's, you know, it's very easy for our young athletes to look at the sport of sailing as, oh, you know, I want to go to the Olympics and I want to be an ocean race sailor. But, you know, there's it's way, way beyond that in terms of opportunities. And it's very clear as we sit here in a place like Concarneau, where, you know, there's a huge transition from the fishing industry into supporting this growing marine performance industry. And, you know, we have some projects like the Marine Hub in Cork, and you know, I think there's a lot more work to do. And again, I think kind of looking over the water, even just to the UK and Cowes and Southampton, we could probably continue to take some good examples.
Yeah, I think sailing seems to be picking itself up on that, that this pathway idea I keep hearing a lot of. I was with the SailGP people in San Francisco last week, and there was lots of talk about how they would, you know, as this circuit developed over the next few years, and it's, you know, it's being bankrolled by Larry Ellison, that it would become, it would create more and more opportunity for people to have proper jobs in the industry, as technicians and shore crew and engineers and, you know, the whole thing that goes around it, as well as sailors.
Yeah, I think when you look at SailGP and the America's Cup is two good examples of that. They're really, you know, creating some very tangible links from the broader blue economy into the sport and back the other way. You know, looking at, you know, hydrogen as a new source of energy, looking at, you know, wave, wind and power and energies and you know, linking various technologies which would typically be in other sectors or you know, feeding back the development and research that are coming from sailing and the sport of sailing at that level back into the kind of broader blue economy industry. So, yeah, absolutely, big opportunities, and I think we Ireland's well placed to be a leader there, and I think that's happening. But we can maybe work to create some more links. I mean, I wasn't necessarily a big proponent of Cork for the America's Cup, but, you know, the kind of philosophy of linking the blue economy and the Marine Hub in Cork Harbour with a big event like that was interesting, but for other reasons.
Yeah, I think it would be nice to see Cork rewarded with a World Series event. I'm not sure whether that's going to happen or not. That's still to be decided. But I think it raised the profile of Cork as because their pitch was very much a kind of tech-based pitch, and you know, perhaps there's other races that could visit there along the way. Maybe an ocean race stop.
Yeah, I think you know, that as you say, there's some interesting matches, but. I have to say, I was looking at one of the articles and leaving, actually literally on the ferry from Ringaskiddy, going out past, going out Cork Harbour. And as we went out past Crosshaven, there was a big swell coming in. And I was like, this doesn't look right to me.
Yeah.
This doesn't look like the right venue to me, and like that's a separate subject, but again, linking kind of marine hubs, the blue economy with our sports, I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
Now, just before we get on to the whole environmental aspect of what you do, I wanted to just ask you about the Steve Fossett Cheyenne round the world record. I remember that, but I don't remember a lot of the detail of it. Just start with telling me about that boat, because some people won't remember that boat, but at the time it was pretty remarkable, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's funny. Actually, I just over the weekend I did a binge read, and I just read all of Jean Le Cam's new book, which kind of took me back even further than I'd started. I think he's kind of got about 12 years on me. So he'd started back with Jet Services, but this was very much I think we called him the Class G at the time, the giant class, and even before that there were boats like TAG and Jet Services and etc. I mean, at the time PlayStation was the biggest structure ever built out of carbon fiber. It was designed by Morelli and Melvin. And it was designed to, break the around the world record. It was managed by Dave Scully. Ben Wright, who's working with us here, was involved as well. And it was all sort of funded by by Steve Fawcett as part of his set of different activities that he was undertaking to set records in an amazing range of different sports, from the Iditarod dog sled race to swimming across the English Channel to ballooning in New Zealand in terms of altitude and around the world. And we were just one of his many activities, which was quite funny, because he was telling us about the Iditarod race, the dog sled race across Alaska, and kind of going, you know, kind of I turned up the first year and just thought that I could kind of buy a good team of dogs and go out there and win the race or whatever. Complete the race, I think, is already just a challenge. And he realized that he had to establish a relationship with the dogs. Otherwise, they wouldn't respect him. Otherwise, they wouldn't basically do what was needed. And he kind of looked at us all. He goes, kind of realized it's the same thing here. I can't just turn up, pay money, and get a result. You know, I kind of got to work with you guys. And I thought that was pretty funny, because we worked with him for quite a few years. And Sean Regan and Ben and the boys changed the bows, and Brian Thompson was involved. They changed the bows on the boat following the first transatlantic. And the boat was just this huge bit of carbon, extremely, I guess, heavy in kind of today's terms, but hugely powerful. And we went out and initially we entered, I believe, the race, which was the Millennium Race in 2000. We crashed and burned and pulled out early, and then came back later on. The boat was called Cheyenne at that stage, and we dragged the boat around the world, kicking and streaming, repairing it as we went, and ended up setting a new record. Steve had kind of refused to pay the Jules Verne organization their small registration fee of, I think it was like, I don't know, it might have been 10,000, but Ben will probably correct me, tell me it was way more. But he wouldn't pay it. He wouldn't pay the Curzon and all of the others in that organization for the right to sail the Jules Verne. He was going to set the record anyway. And actually, when we completed the round the world and set a new record, it was the first time in that the actual record was and the Jules Verne record were different.
Because, right.
The outright was faster. We set it. So anyway, that was an amazing experience. R.I.P. Steve went on to do other things and ultimately ended up having an accident in the on a recce somewhere in the American desert of flying on his own. But he used to often, I think, stay in touch with quite a few of us, and you know, kind of liked the idea of staying in touch with the sailing world. When he first got into it, actually, he entered, Dave Scully helped him to enter into the Route de Rhum, and he ended up finishing third on his first Route de Rhum, single-handed in an Armour Trimaran. Pretty amazing. So, you know, listen, he was an older guy. He wasn't the most athletic of us, but and he was quite introvert, but he was intelligent in his approach, and you don't set the amount of records that Steve had done across so many disciplines without having a kind of a pragmatic, intelligent approach to it.
He really was a remarkable individual. I mean, just I'm sure there are books about him. I'm interested that he was introverted, because, you know, from the outside, he seems pretty outgoing doing all these incredible adventures, because he wasn't quiet about them. They were in the public eye. Did you get to know him well?
I think we all did to a certain extent. I mean, you can't spend that much time on a boat with someone without learning a little bit about them. And you know, we would get those moments, whether, you know, it's just been a tough night on watch and you're sitting underneath the cubby, or you're down below kind of looking at the computer screen, and sometimes he'd just kind of break out these anecdotes. And kind of the one of the Iditarod, I think, is the one I prefer, but there are others as well, where he was kind of doing his ballooning with Branson, or getting ready for his next glider attempt, wherever that was. Very special man.
Good man to meet. I'm interested as well, a boat like that was so different to everything else. As a crew, how did you approach that? Did you have to learn how to sail that boat? Was it different to everything else you'd sailed?
I just heavier. You know, I guess when you kind of come from sailing a Tornado or an Orma, and you kind of get onto something like that, it's possibly like moving from a Ferrari to a tractor. The task is still the same. The wheels turn in the same direction, but they kind of, you know, it's the feedback happens in different ways. You kind of, you know, maybe where an Orma might lift the central hull and you kind of know you're reaching the limit with that boat, it's more about the sounds and the feels and the movement of the boat through the waves. And, you know, I guess the task of sailing, whether you're going from a, you know, a skiff to an Etchells or back the other way, it's still the same thing. But the feedback happens in different ways at different speeds. And I think that's maybe where, you know, especially when we look at the more modern boats and SailGP, the reaction times and the mechanisms, the tools are different, but the fundamental activity is still the same.
Boats like that were the precursors to the Ultims, were they, ultimately?
Yes, I think there was, that was really very much the old school. It was more like TAG and Jet Services. I can't remember the names of some of the others. I guess the Olliers were the three Ollier catamarans that were built for the race were probably the precursor of boats like Groupama and Banque Populaire, which came along later. And you know, now, of course, and there's another generation altogether with, Francois' boat just went out for a quick trial run today, having just hit the water last week. So, you know, these boats are now foiling and you know, apparent when sailing in boats of that size is amazing. You know, to kind of look at the speeds and the capacity that they have to sail faster than the wind, even in kind of reasonable sea states it's amazing.
What would you say if you got the offer to go and do a lap of the planet from Francois?
Oh, yeah, ready to go. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, you know, my kind of great pleasure at the moment is getting back windsurfing. And it kind of provides me with a kind of a personal little escape to get out in the water. I grew up windsurfing, and it's kind of fun to get back into it now with more modern gear and something. And it's a lot easier for an old fella like myself. And actually, as it, you know, with regards to the sailing industry itself, I think my real passion at the moment and focus is and has been for more than a few years now the more fundamental raison d'être. What are we doing and why are we doing it, and what are our impacts? Because at the end of the day, it's fun, and I think you'll never get old going out for a good burn or you know, having a nice race around a race course. But you know, you come in at the end of the day and you come last or first or whatever it is, but you know, fundamentally it doesn't change who you are. But kind of when I look at my kids and maybe see them looking at me, I think kind of the biggest impact I can have is maybe helping us to consider you know, what we're doing from a more holistic standpoint, and that's important to me now.
And you've had a fantastic opportunity with the 11th Hour organization. You're part of the team, but you work so closely with the charity, which I think most people are probably aware of. How did that come about? Did you kind of drift into that, or was that a deliberate move on your part?
A bit of both, I would say. I think fundamentally it kind of, again, goes back to who I am and where I grew up. My parents probably had a kind of fairly large hand to play in, I guess, you know, kind of the way we were brought up as well, my brother and myself. More recently, I think my first real contact with modern sustainability, even though we didn't think of it in those terms at that time, was the Oman Sail Project. And very much more around the human aspect of sustainability, and using the sport of sailing and the platform of sailing for other reasons rather than just kind of getting around the race course as fast as possible in media minutes and hours and lines. And so it's kind of, I think that was the first sort of expansion, I guess, in terms of why we're getting out in the water. I think more and more so in those days, organizations and companies and sponsors were looking for additional internal co-benefits from sponsorship, not just boat across the you know finish line and media return. And so well, Mansell worked that really hard and with many different goals, but it was really about developing youth, the Oman youth, and obviously Oman is a tourist destination as another objective. And then I'd been living in Canada. I'd worked actually for 6 years as the education manager for the Canadian Wildlife Federation, which, if you like, it's kind of like the Canadian version of WWF. Mm. And so that, I guess, really spoke to a passion of mine, which was education. And I'd done sort of a lot of outdoor education and education outdoors as a young person in Ireland. And, you know, so for about 6 years, I was working both for Oman Sail and for CWF. I believe around that time, I did at least one or two ocean races and came in contact, quite frankly, with Mark Towell and Charlie Enright. They were putting a campaign together. I think they saw me as an athlete, as a sailor, but at the time, I realize now they also saw me as someone who had a growing understanding of what of the importance of sustainability and the kind of broader the broader objectives. And so I, with Vestas 11th Hour Racing, 17 to 18, we had 12 months to start, implement and basically put in place a team with the capacity to enter and win the ocean race and to apply sustainability both on site and beyond the team itself. So that quickly became my role. I did one leg and then shifted to that role, which was really fulfilling. And by that stage, I was like, this is where I want to spend most of my effort. And if I've got a bit of spare time, I'm happy to get out in the water. So I kind of rather big shift for me and something that wasn't that easy at the start, I have to say. But now there's no doubt in my mind that I'm doing the right thing.
Yeah, you're in a unique position, aren't you? Because you've got a foot in both camps now. You've got that all-important experience of being a sailor, of being a competitor in the race, and you understand what's important to win the race, but you can now balance that with all of the other stuff that you know, I mean, you guys are innovating and breaking new ground with that. It seems like everything you do now, it seems to be just hardwired into the whole process.
Well, I think that probably makes it sound a lot easier and groundbreaking than it is. So, you know, this campaign, we have a very specific task, which was in 2019 to take an old boat, design and build a new boat, train with both of them, enter a team in the ocean race and win, or set ourselves up for winning. These are the tasks we're working towards. And then equally as important to embed sustainability across everything we do, to look at the challenges that exist within the industry that we can tackle or that need more resource or collaboration to be tackled, and to work with others to achieve basically a transition. So that as we get towards 2030, we can start thinking about reducing our global footprints by 50%. That's 7% a year, which is no small task. And those first few reductions are relatively possible and easy. But by the time we kind of get a couple of years in, you know, it's harder and harder to find those reductions of impacts we fundamentally really need to look at the rules that we're racing under as classes, as events, because there's only so much we can do to reduce these impacts within the rules as they exist.
Yeah, that was the thing I picked up in particular from the report. Was I think it was you'd gone as far as you could go within the rules that you were having to work to. Is that a realistic expectation that? I mean, are you pushing against an open door or a closed door with the organizers of these races?
Well, I think it's, I mean, first of all, we've got to get in there to understand what these challenges are. And I think this is very much the opportunity that 11th Hour Racing team have, which is to explore the status quo as it exists, to try and work within that status quo to apply the very best practice that we can. And we made a lot of mistakes, but we've done a lot of good things as well. You know, that's all included in the report, where the opportunities lie to do better than we've already done. And then, as you say, there's a point where to have significant further reductions of impact, and it's not just about doing less bad, but really how can we do more better? How can we make the sectors of influence and operation better for our presence? And we decided to work towards net positive as a campaign, rather than just simply net zero, where we're trying to reduce our impacts. We're really trying to ensure that wherever we're working, we're leaving things better for our presence. And that sort of appears in different ways. In some cases, it's about putting into place recycling carbon recycling initiatives where they don't exist. In others, it's about providing a list of observations or possibly recommendations, if we're careful how we say that, to our peers and our partners and to the class as a whole. And honestly, when we arrived in 2019, we arrived very carefully, sort of carefully placed our bag and opened the door and stepped into our office and made the first few calls and emails. And we were very surprised, happily surprised, by the welcome that we got. And honestly, companies like Kairos just across the road have been working in the alternative materials space for a long time. And they said to us, you guys have just arrived at the right time. There's a growing awareness across the industry that this is important. Just most of us don't understand where to start, what tools to use, and what the ultimate objective is. And so this is an ongoing discussion that we've helped to be part of, and it's currently transforming in terms of, you know, into new rules, in this case within the Amoca class. But I want to just focus on the Amoca class, but it's obviously one of our primary areas of influence. And so just to kind of put on the table a few definitive examples, they've created an alternative materials rule, which basically incentivizes the use of alternative materials in components on board, which can be removed at the moment of measurement. And therefore, it provides actually a performance benefit at the moment of measurement. And therefore, it incentivizes the class and the technicians and designers to experiment and use more of these materials. It's a small first step, but a really important one. So that's one example. From a development class, they're really looking, they've always looked at budget and the kind of increasing budget of these of this class, which is going in the wrong direction currently. And so right now they're looking at two ways of limiting the sales. One in terms of, which is very simple, honestly, and just in terms of buttons and limited sales per cycle, which we're all familiar with in many other classes, but it's fundamental. And the other is the concept of a green sale, defining what is a green sale in terms of recyclability, longevity, materials used, circularity of materials used. And so the intention is to design a rule around a sale which will incentivize designers and builders to look at the way we use sales and the circularity thereof. One sales incidents, for instance, as well, are quite engaged in the process. So that's just two examples of how Amoca have taken this on. But fundamentally, they've been looking at this topic for a long time. And I think, you know, when we look at SailGP, the Ocean Race, even the America's Cup, it's become more of a sustainability has become more of a integrated business plan, an operational plan, than just some sort of nice corporate social responsibility, which is kind of which appears in the form of saving the albatross or counting turtles on the beach, which are both important, but aren't integrated sustainability. You know, if we want to make change, we have to do it from within the organizations and save the albatross and the turtles. But fundamentally, we need to look at our core impacts. What are we building boats from? What energy are we using to build those boats from? Who are building the boats, and are they safe and healthy? And that's modern sustainability, which is quite different from, I think, you know, sort of 1960s, 80s approach to pointing to from the outside in, going, this is all bad, we've got to change the world. The only way we're going to change things is from doing it inside.
You're sitting on the inside of it all. Do you have positive thoughts about it, like strong hopes for success around this in the long term, I mean?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, listen, it's not something that happens overnight. We've got some really big challenges. The use of carbon fiber and, you know, other high impact materials in our industry are so embedded that it's hard to see where alternatives will come from. But then again, you know, I think it comes right back to the rules and some of the reasons that we're out there in the first place. And we just need to put sustainability on the table at the same time as performance and budget in every discussion, so that when we're designing, when we're, you know, drawing out the race rules or race route, when we're deciding what defines a class, when we're deciding what the parameters are for designing or building a boat or a project, that sustainability is at the table. And by, ultimately, probably setting an internal price of carbon, so that whether it's a tangible price, which is compensated for through carbon credits, or whether it's just a high internal rate of carbon, which helps to drive policy and decision making internally. I think we just have to now quantify and take responsibility for the impact of our budgets and the decisions associated with those budgets. So if we build a boat that has got 500 tons of carbon dioxide impact, then we need to compensate accordingly. And next time, we need to build rules which will reduce that and maybe set a threshold. And I think that's the direction that some of the classes are heading in, and I hope that the IMOCA is heading that way too.
It sounds fantastic. It's I think the fact that you've thrown the stone in the pond now, the ripples are spreading out. Until you did that, then we probably would have just kept on going down the same route.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, there's where there are many of us from, you know, of our peers and many of the other teams, you know, I'd name Militia, I'd name Linked Out, many of the other events, of course, the Ocean Race, but SailGP and many others who are, you know, especially in France here, the Class 40s, the Mini Class, they're all proactively either, you know, working within committees or smaller groups or as teams to address these different issues. And I think where we need to be careful is that it's easy to look over from one class to the other and go, oh, well, you know, well, they're really bad. Look how big and fast they go. But at the end of the day, you know, we're all in the same sector and we're all in the same industry with fundamentally all the same questions. You know, materials, the impact that we have on the race course, on the environment, the biodiversity, marine mammal, you know, strikes, all of these issues. And I think if we can take a net positive approach whereby we're not trying to do less bad, but we're actually trying to make things better by our presence in every sector of operation and influence, then we can only get better. As sailors and as an industry, we're fundamentally wired to innovate. That's what we do. That's why we are now flying around above the water doing plus 50 knots. So we have the capacity. We just now need to really put in the specs, or the cahier de charges, we would say in French, you know, the criteria that you place on the table at the outset, whether it's designing a class, a boat, or an event, sustainability needs to be there. And we need to internalize the externalities which have been ignored to date.
You're a great advocate for all of this. Let me take you back to the sailing now. These Amoca 60s, the new ones, the boat you've just helped design and build, they're pretty remarkable, aren't they? Can you compare and contrast them with the VO 70s? I mean, they were the ones that all the Volvo sailors went misty-eyed over. These are something different, or development, or how do you view it?
Very different boats. VO 70 is a hugely powerful boat, still heavy, still in the water. A lot of fun to sail. It took a couple of additions to the extent that they sort of became reliable and provided really close racing, I would say. But the Amoca is a different class altogether. They're, you know, more and more now designed and conceived to fly out of the water and to reduce weighted surface area. They're designed originally, of course, around shorthanded sailing. Even the boats now that are being optimized for the ocean race are still optimized around a crew of four. So still very, very different to the Volvo 70. The foils, the capacity of the foils and the boat itself to kind of push beyond what is possible for both the boat and the sailors means that they're going to have to be careful. I think it's naturally that happens when you're shorthanded, because there's, you know, you only have so much capacity to reduce sail, and you have to build in a certain kind of threshold, which is naturally lower when you're on your own or even double-handed. When you're fully crewed, that threshold no longer kind of exists until you go beyond the physical boundaries of the boat or the people on board. And so I think for the first time for many, the sailors will be lifting the foot, even if the boat can physically or theoretically go faster. They're amazing. It'd be interesting to see where the future of the class takes us. These rules go out until the next Vendée Globe, 2024, 25. And then the new version of the rules will come into play. Some of the questions that are on the table today is, what's the future of the foils? Are they going to be limited even further? Are they going to be one design? Does the class want the boat to start fully foiling, which would require another foil or trim tab towards the back of the boat? What are they going to do about the kind of ever-increasing budget size and the sort of potential unevenness across the fleet in terms of the old boats and the new boats? So all of these questions are being discussed already this year, so that by the time we get to 24, 25, after the Vendée Globe, we'll have basically a new pathway. But right now, there's a whole batch of new boats being built, both for the ocean race, which is coming up quickly, and they're all for finish now, of course, and most importantly for the Vendée Globe. So it's just an amazing class to be involved in. And honestly, from when I was involved for the Barcelona race with Jean-Pierre, the boats are so different. It's another world altogether.
So a two-part question to kind of start to round off here. Would you be tempted to do a leg if Mark and Charlie drafted you in?
I think that's very unlikely with the reduced number of sailors on board and the fact that I haven't put my boots on in a while. I think they've got many, honestly, the team is built as part of any strategy of a team looking at an event like this. We've built in a strategy of sailors which will cover redundancy in terms of skipper, navigator, technicians on board and crew, and so we've got some of the world's best sailors in our rotation, which are already training with us, and we've got a couple of new sailors, I believe, coming in this for this period. So I don't have any expectations, and I'm not holding my breath to get out for a sail otherwise, apart from a bit of the kind of work up here. And that's all in good, because Amy, my colleague in the sustainability department, and myself, we've got plenty on.
I'm sure you have. So my other favorite question to ask my guests these days is the Vendée Globe. Would you ever?
Yes.
Interesting. You could cope with being on your own for that length of time?
That's a question that I hear quite a bit, but I never heard a French person asking me that. And I think it's just possibly because the way we look at, I think with the way we look at the sport of single-handed sailing in France is it's less of an adventure and more of a sport, be it that the Vendée Globe is obviously a huge adventure. And so the task of competing, you know, kind of more than overrides the notion that you're on your own for quite a long time. And so for me, if I entered the Vendée Globe, ever got the opportunity to, it would be to compete and hopefully to compete well. If I have not done to date, it's probably because I've been focused on other projects and other people's projects. And also, I guess, had the sort of I don't know if this has been wrong and right, but I've always wanted to basically undertake anything with the opportunity to do well from the outset, and rather reluctant to just kind of just go there to kind of I'll do one to see and kind of just put a toe in the water and then kind of do another. Obviously, something like that requires is a very serious undertaking and requires a serious budget alongside. So. I basically just have never taken the time to stand aside, put into place a project manager and a fundraiser and to go out there and look for the money. Ireland has never had an entry that has completed that event, and it deserves it. I know that quite a few good sailors have looked at it, even again recently. So short answer, no, I would not turn that opportunity down if it came through with the right colour.
Fantastic. Fantastic answer. So what are the milestones now for the team? Do you guys feel like you're on track from a competitor's point of view for the Ocean Race? Starts in January next year.
Yeah, listen, I mean, we've already had a sort of 9-12 months delay. So we're ready to go. This year is very much about putting the boat, which was put into the water very quickly for the last Jacques Vabre, which went out and performed well until we had a technical issue or two. So we know the potential of the boat. We're just working now on the reliability of the boat, and that's what the team have been working on over the last 3 months. We've got a transatlantic to take the boat back to its home, Newport, Rhode Island, and spend a couple of months of the summer there. Then another transatlantic to bring it back. Final tech prep, and then down to Alicante for the start. So, listen, it's more now about lining, you know, the reliability of the boat, and then the kind of the lining up with the boats that end up on the start line, and trying to figure out, you know, how many boats are we going to have on the start line? What kind of race are we going to have on our hands? But we've been, put it this way, we've been kind of emotionally ready for quite a while. I think the guys are really looking forward to getting out in the water and doing some proper sailing with the boat with no stress and all the time now to prepare for the rest of the year. And then I think they're going to be really excited when they get the first lineups towards the end of the year and as we head towards the Ocean Race.
It's tremendously exciting. It must be fantastic to be a part of that whole thing. So congratulations on that. Damien, thanks for taking the time to talk to me. I've really enjoyed it. I'm sure the listeners will do too. And hopefully we'll catch up with you again, maybe once the Ocean Race is done, and we can find out how much progress we've made on the sustainability side.
Thank you very much, Justin. Have a good day, everyone.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My thanks to Damien Foxall for spending time with me. And thanks, as always, to each and every one of you for listening and subscribing. Your support really means a great deal to me. I'll be back soon with another exclusive interview from the professional sailing world. And until then, I'll just sign off by saying, sail fast, everyone.